The Day the World Ended at Little Bighorn, a Lakota History by Joseph M. Marshall III. Chapter 9, The Long Knives. Milahuska, they were called. Long Knives, one of the distinctive features immediately noticed by the first Lakota to see soldiers of the U.S. Army, was the sword. So the name stuck. The word Akichita is now used for soldier. Lakota people used the word in reference to the 19th century soldier, but it was not initially applied until after the turn of the 20th century. Among pre-reservation Lakota warrior societies, the Akichita were the men charged with keeping order when camps relocated or during buffalo hunts. After Lakota young men joined the U.S. Army and served during World War I, Akichita became soldier. It was the Lakota word that came closest to describing what the soldier did. Today, when young Lakota people join any branch of the U.S. military, their families say, Akichita o papi, or they have joined the soldiers. But in 1876, the soldiers were Milahuska. Most Lakota felt the only good thing about them was their weapons, and the worst thing was that they simply would not go away. They were rightfully perceived to be instruments of the Great Father and of the peace talkers. The President of the United States was given the title of Great Father by the peace commissioners or peace talkers, the representatives of the U.S. government sent to negotiate with the native tribes. In this hierarchy, the soldiers were the people sent to enforce the will of the Great Father and his peace talkers, or inflict punishment if the Lakota and other tribes had done something wrong. The Lakota and Northern Cheyenne faced in battle some 1,600 soldiers that summer of 1876, not to mention the 300 Crow and Shoshone who rode with General Crook and 50 scouts with Custer. They fought Crook's force of 1,300 to a standstill on June 17th and manhandled Custer's 650 men on the 25th. As far as the Lakota were concerned, two factors were always constant with the soldiers. One, they fought to kill and killed indiscriminately. And two, they were always well armed with plenty of ammunition and often had wagon guns, a field cannon, or howitzer. On that June day, the soldiers' intentions and orders were to ride into the encampment where the women and children were. This is not hard to believe, considering Custer's and his regiment's attitude towards non-combatants. In fact, General Philip Sheridan once described George Custer, the commander of the 7th, as a man who wept with his wife at sentimental drama, but who would ride whooping with his troops over an Indian village full of women and children. So when Custer arrived at the fort at Medicine Tail Coulee, hundreds of women and children were in full flight, strung out on the floodplain to the northwest across the river. They would have been easy to spot from Medicine Tail Coulee. Custer did proceed north from the coulee, perhaps with the intention of circling back to the west to cut off and capture the fleeing women and children. But his truest intentions will never be known because Lakota warriors crossed the ford and pursued him, forcing him to run and fight simultaneously. At about the same time that Custer and his five companies were being pursued up and away from Medicine Tail Coulee, Major Marcus Reno, second in command of the 7th Cavalry, and the remnants of his companies were digging in on a ridge overlooking the river 3 miles to the south. Captain Frederick Benteen, one of the 7th senior company commanders, was returning from his reconnaissance to the south and was about to join Reno. Neither Major Reno nor Captain Benteen were favorites of Custer's. On that ridge, about 375 soldiers, including those with the pack train, became tactically ineffective. Like Custer and his five companies, they would be reduced to basic survival mode. The 7th Cavalry was formed by the U.S. Army in 1866 and headquartered at Fort Riley in Kansas. Most of the senior officers, such as Reno and Benteen, were with the regiment almost from the beginning. The regiment's main duty seemed to be harassing tribes on the southern plains. An incident in late November of 1868 on the Washita River in what is now Kansas, known as the Battle of the Washita, set the tone for the 7th Cavalry's purpose. The regiment attacked Black Kettle's Southern Cheyenne village at dawn, while most of the men were away. In addition to combatants, they killed women and children and took captives. A stellar achievement in the eyes of the army, perhaps, but regarded as a cowardly act by most of the Southern Plains tribes. Overall, the seventh stint on the Southern Plains region was unspectacular, but the regiment was assigned other duty as well. From 1871 to 1873, and again from 1874 to 1876, several of the 7th's companies were sent to the Reconstruction South to do what was called constabulary duties. Throughout the 7th Cavalry's early years, it was plagued with desertions, sometimes as high as 50%. The glory of being Indian fighters alone was apparently not enough to keep soldiers in the field. The problem angered Lieutenant Colonel George Custer to the point that he ordered deserters shot. Interestingly, Custer himself was suspended from duty for a year for being AWOL, absent without leave. In 1873, the regiment was reassigned to Fort Abraham Lincoln in Dakota Territory across the Missouri River from the present state capital of Bismarck, North Dakota. Prior to their arrival, Fort Abraham Lincoln was an infantry post, but their units had difficulty matching the Hunkpapa Lakota. The well-mounted Hunkpapa, as it turned out, was much too mobile for the infantry companies. So continued requests from the post commander for a cavalry unit eventually brought the 7th to the Northern Plains, and in early August of that year, they met their future foes. The 7th was assigned to escort a survey expedition laying out a route for a railroad, mainly through what is now eastern Montana. West of the present town of Miles City, the escort party clashed with Ogallala, Hunkpapa, and Minikanju warriors led by Crazy Horse. That was the first encounter between Crazy Horse and the 7th Cavalry. Neither side, however, inflicted significant casualties on the other. The following year, the regiment became more of a threat to the Lakota when it was dispatched to the Black Hills to confirm the rumors of the discovery of gold. The posting at Fort Abraham Lincoln would, of course, make them part of the U.S. Army's plan to capture the defiant Lakota in the summer of 1876. On May 17th, they marched out of Fort Abraham Lincoln as part of a larger force commanded by General Alfred E. Terry. Most of the men of the 7th Cavalry probably had never seen Plains Indians until they enlisted or until their posting at Fort Abraham Lincoln, although some of them had seen service in the Civil War. Within the 7th's ranks, nearly 20 European languages were spoken. Many of the men were not American citizens, and at least three were part Native. The average age was mid to late 20s. Because the Army preferred smaller men for the cavalry, most of the 7th soldiers were between 5 feet 3 inches and 5 feet 8 inches tall. U.S. Army records indicate fewer than 6 men who were 6 feet tall or over. Of course, part of the 7th's roster included the scouts, 51 in all, from at least 6 different tribes. The regiment was perhaps more in retrospect styled as an elite fighting force. Yet at the time, armed budgetary constraint severely limited target practice for soldiers in the field. Another bothersome factor would prove just as costly later. The Army issued copper cartridge casings for the Springfield rifle, frequently cracked after repeated firing and jammed in the breech, which made reloading difficult. As a result, many officers purchased their own ammunition. This was apparently one of the liabilities the 7th carried into the field in the summer of 1876. General Terry was in overall command at Fort Abraham Lincoln. The 7th was easily half of that command, which included 3 companies of infantry and nearly 200 civilians employed by the Army. As long as the terrain and weather conditions were favorable to the large troop movement, the 7th was highly mobile. On the whole, American troops posted on the Northern Plains were formidable when operating at large unit strength, primarily because of their firepower. 2 Gatling guns were part of the ordnance Terry took into the field. Conventional military units depend on unit cohesion and the ability of each of these of their subgroups to function adequately. Further, unit cohesion must depend on several factors, chief among them the ability of the unit commander, be it the company commander or squad leader, to maintain command and control, and the ability of the individual soldier to perform well in the midst of chaos, confusion, and fear. If the unit commander does not quickly evaluate the tactical situation at hand or gain effective control of it, the consequences can be disastrous. To this end, soldiers were trained to function as a unit under the authority of one unit leader or commander. If leadership was not exercised or exercised poorly or eliminated by the enemy, the unit lost its cohesion. If the next in line did not assume command, unit cohesion could have been lost permanently. The final opportunity to prevent total disorganization then rested on each individual soldier, and how that soldier performed depended on the training he had received as well as the depth of his character and courage. Despite their often heinous behavior, there were some soldiers at the Little Bighorn who were not only tenacious fighters but also courageous. During the night of June 25th, 15 soldiers from Reno Benteen contingent risked their lives by going down to the river for water for their wounded comrades. They had to work their way through brush and rough terrain, and the Lakota and Northern Cheyenne who were waiting in the dark. The members of the water detail fought their way to the river and back. Rightly, they were decorated for their bravery. It should be noted, however, that the three engagements over 2 days at the Little Bighorn were probably the first time that the 7th Cavalry fought a Native military force on an equal basis. At the Washita in Kansas in 1868, Custer's attacking force was 800 men strong against Black Kettle's village of 300, not all of them warriors. Although Custer was able to divide his forces for a potent four-pronged attack and to take control of the village in only a few minutes, he still had a fight on his hands. Sporadic firing from Cheyenne men and boys hidden in the trees and from along the Washita River and from the nearby hills was an unexpected challenge, and after sundown, Cheyenne warriors returned, perhaps as many as 1,000 or more, and surrounded what remained of the village. Custer, realizing he was outnumbered, withdrew his men. At the Little Bighorn, however, he did not have the option to withdraw from the field. He had no choice but to fight the kind of cavalry engagement in which the Lakota and Cheyenne excelled. 300 soldiers of the 7th Cavalry found their final resting place at the Little Bighorn. The spin doctors of the day wrote sensational news accounts and fueled the fires of revenge because the elite 7th Cavalry had been massacred by savages. But the truth is, pound for pound, man for man, the soldiers who rode into the valley of the Little Bighorn were not equal to the Lakota and Northern Cheyenne as fighters. They did not have the years of training and individual skills at combat arms. Furthermore, their duty was determined by the generals and policymakers who sent them on the missions to capture and kill Indians. Their fate was sealed when their commander divided his tired, exhausted force into four columns because Custer believed that the Lakota would break and run at the sight of soldiers. In spite of being outnumbered, the 7th Cavalry had considerable firepower. Perhaps they actually believed that righteousness was on their side as well, and thereby expected to be victorious. Many of them were probably surprised, therefore, at the level of ferocity and skill with which the Lakota and Northern Cheyenne warriors fought. No doubt the soldiers tried to perform the duty they were sent out to do, but they failed. Ironically, their failure was commemorated and a monument was raised to them. The real irony is that the Long Knives did not die defending their nation against invaders. They were the invaders. This concludes the reading of Chapter 9.
Kayamako chiket hemakita cha pesho dakere pamakashka yero hayamia akichita omakia o hayayo.
This program is made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.